Tell me the point about Mrs. Fawcett and why you didn't go to anything except the main meetings in the 20s then.
That was really because the Mrs. Dame Millicent had left, you know, the presidency and so on, and my recollection is that Eleanor Rathbone had ceased too, though I'm a little vague on that at the moment. But the thing that antagonized, in a sense, a good many of us was that those in control of it, I was then off the board after about 14 years, got it to support the Labour Party entirely and not support the men in the other parties who had been for years, many of them friendly, even brought in bills in the old days. And that really led to a chilliness on the part of the other women. And it meant that the thing fell into the hands of those who liked the Labour tie up. Now, Mary Stocks was in that. And Mrs. Hubbock, I consider, was the secretary, you know, like Marjorie had been. And I consider that she was the person who kind of manoeuvred it all. That's my feeling, that she managed to get it. I was away, of course, a lot of that time. You know, I was in America often for lecture tours and things. So, I think that, and that was what made it so that the older suffragists like myself really weren't so identified with that. Except, as I say, that, you remember, I gave you one cutting of a big meeting in 25, for instance, and I would be asked to speak, you see, often. Sundays, you know, all sorts of times on the women's movement. And I wrote a great deal. In fact, I began the habit of writers doing a review of the women's activities in the year.
What for, actually, Mrs. Morris?
Well, I did those off the Manchester Guardian. You took that. And the Glasgow Bulletin, which is the Herald's paper, it took that. The Herald, of course, took others. And I had articles of that kind. One, I think, if I remember, in The Observer. I got into the best papers, and I did start that, and then a lot of other journalists in a year or two copied that reviewing of mine. I used to review the women's activities. And, of course, I sent those to... Some of them went... I think one of them went to Canada, to one of the would be a Montreal paper, I imagine. I've got... Anyhow, that was what I was doing, and writing on women and speaking, but not identified closely with the old organisation.
And were these younger women on the whole? I mean, Mary Stocks was younger, of course.
Yes,
than you,
yes, yes. And I would say Mrs. Hubbard was younger than me, too. I would say so. Difficult. She wasn't so young. Well, yes, she probably was. But it was that, you see, and then a lot of them, like Soddy's wife, Mrs. Soddy, and Mrs. Osler, and Mrs. Keane's mother, you see, they had sort of, when the first vote was granted, they rather retired a little into... Mrs. Keane's, for instance, was very active in Cambridge, you know. Well, they retired, and it meant that a great many of the... what I call the leading constitutionalists really had left it in one way. We hadn't deserted the cause. We were still working for it in our own spheres, but we had deserted staying in the organisation so actively. And that was partly because of that saying that they were to support the Labour Party alone at an election. Well, that really was quite unfair, because the Pankhursts had opposed the government, you remember.
Yes, any government.
any government, which had a sort of logic. But I think to see that you was to support the Labour Party and pay no attention to men like Mond and the Conservatives, who were, had been, some of them had been good all down the years, for 20 years, you might say, and they were just scrap.
Yes, that's interesting. It's very difficult to discover that sort of thing from written records.
It is,
you know,
because I don't think anything was ever written
about it.
And nobody would have gone on record as saying much against it. You see what I mean?
I understand.
Nobody would have gone on record saying that they didn't like it.
Yes. Did you join a branch of the National Union? I mean, were you a member of a particular branch in the 20s? I mean, was it like the NUWSS in that way, with branches?
Yes, it was. I can't remember whether I was officially a member of branch of...
you were really a
I was a branch. I was a member of the Glasgow branch, and I think I retained that membership, though I wasn't much. I was up there now and then in Scotland speaking, but I did an awful lot of work in Cardiff, in Wales, but Cardiff in particular, and. I might have joined that too. I am a little bit, but I did remain as a Glasgow.
But you weren't really a local operator at all.
Really,
you were a national figure.
Because I was national, you see, and I was always speaking all over. And I actually, as you know, went to Ireland and got my head broken.
How did that happen?
Well, I went very silly. Miss Cumming, who was the daughter of a professor at Cork, took me with another girl to a factory, and they came out about noon, I would say, suppose for lunch, from a factory outside of Cork, not even near a house, you know, sort of by itself, and they started. I had something to stand on, I think. You know, I can't remember. Anyhow, they didn't even begin to listen. They started to shout and throw stones. Started to throw things at us, first of all, clods of earth. And I said to Miss Cumming after a little while, we must walk away. And I said to her, walk slowly. Because there were a nasty crowd. There were men, you see, and women. And we started to walk slowly, and they kept following us, throwing all sorts of things at it. And then they started to throw pieces of tin, I don't know, there was a lot of rubbish about, you know, at our feet. And I knew that if they got us down, we could have been almost killed, because they'd have trampled on us. And I turned right round and faced them. And, of course, Miss Cumming turned round too when I did. I stopped dead, turned round and faced them. And they threw a stone, and the stone took my hat off. And they threw a second stone, and it hit me there. Mm-hmm. And it was as if a bullet hit me. It was so, really, I know what a bullet's like from that. It was a man threw it, and it hit me. And, of course, and I screamed involuntarily. But I saw that my scream frightened them, so I went on screaming deliberately for a good minute or two, you see, screaming loudly and fiercely. I'm a great believer in a scream, you know. And they stopped and drew back, and I could see the blood running down onto my suit, you know, I couldn't sketch on. And I said, and they... I said, they drew back, you know, sort of frightened at the sight of all the blood and things. And I put my hand out like that and said to a girl standing in the front, pick up that hat. I wasn't going to stoop, you know, but there's a gang there. And she picked it up and I said, bring it to me. With my father's voice, as I used to say. And she brought it to me and I said, now get out. You know. And they went. And I went to the nearest house and got water and, you know, sort of stones this, and a doctor bound it up. It's still, you know, if I put anything sure on that, it's still, it could cut down the earth, I think. A doctor banded up, and the doctor, when I got home to Glasgow, said, it was, you know, he did that as if he'd been cut in a public house. He said it isn't properly, nicely done at all, you know. Anyhow, that was my experience in Cork. Now, that girl, Miss Cumming shouldn't have taken me there. It was too risky, you see. And there were no police about. If she'd taken me, she should have told the police, I think, in Cork. But anyhow, that was the only time I was absolutely hushed in the suffrage,
was it? That was sort of before the First World
War.
Oh,
that was in suffrage. I was speaking for suffrage in Ireland. Yes. And, of course, what they did all the time was shouted at you, do you believe in home rule? Mm-hmm. You know, except in the drawing rooms and the more cultured parts of Ireland, you didn't get quiet audiences. You got the kind that shouted, what about home rule? I used to say we don't take part and we don't make statements on party things in our movement, but they didn't like that, of course. If I said I'm a home ruler, I suppose, but I thought, well, it isn't right to say it, even to please them. I just said, no, we don't make statements on party, on political issues. We didn't, you know. Anyhow, that was the only time I was ever injured. I've had things thrown at me, you know.
Have you?
Oh, tomatoes and rubbish, you know.
Have you
really? Oh, yes, that was the only time I really was. The nastiest thing was that Cambon.
Well, the procession.
Now, nasty. Mm. That, if it had gone on much longer and we hadn't been rescued, you know, by the pub, the hotel, that could have been really nasty.
Can you describe it like you did the Irish thing? Can you just describe what happened? I mean,
in Cambon?
Yes. Yes,
that was the kind of rushes at us, you see, and taking the thing. We had a...
And you arrived in the procession, I suppose, did you, from further west?
It was a group of us, yes, and we went out into the open air in the early evening to have a meeting, and I had a lorry, a sort of truck, you know, quite a high one. And you see, what they did to... They started pushing that with me on it. I got the other women to get down, you know, quickly. And they started pushing that and driving it about. And if they had been in a place where there were loose stones, that would have been very nasty. But you see, they were in an ordinary square. And they hadn't got the kind of things at their hand that crowd in Ireland had. Or I think we'd have got it. They were a nasty... I don't know why they were so nasty. It still puzzles me, because it was the only place we encountered anything like that.
Were they organised? I mean, were the people directing things?
Yes, there seemed to be a group of men who were really leading it. There seemed to be a small group that were the ringleaders, if you could call them that. But
young
I can't
men?
Think why, because as I see it, the other places, they were all friendly.
Mm. Were they young men, or sort of teenagers?
A lot of them were men old enough to know better, so to speak. But they were younger men, you know, like the 20s.
Mm.
Not boys. They were really... Mm. No, they looked like the miners.
You were the only person on the lorry, and they dragged it along, didn't
dragged
they?
Dragged it
with
about,
you on it?
And in the end I did get that. Yes, some nice friendly men, you see, rather got in and pushed off the men from around the lorry a little, and so that I could get down among them and get through, you know. Some friendly men. There were men in the crowd who didn't approve. You could see that, you see.
Yes.
But that was a curious incident, because, as I say, no other meeting in the tour was anything but friendly.
So you got away into a hotel, did you?
The hotel, it took us in. We were staying in it, most of us, I think, if I remember. And they locked all the doors, which was sure they thought it was rather bad. You see, they locked all their doors and let nobody in at all for quite a time. And they said to us, come back into a sort of inner room, so that they didn't even see us, you know. I think they were afraid they might break windows, you see. They didn't, though. They didn't.
Because it must be worrying in that sort of situation. You're responsible for the younger women, aren't you, really?
Yes, I...
Did they panic at all on that occasion?
Yes, well, the one who was awfully upset about was an older woman, Mrs. Ramsay. I got them down and I got them in, you see, quite quickly. If you're in charge, of course, you have to do those things. Just as in Ireland, if I hadn't acted, I don't know what would have happened to Miss Cumming and the other girl, because if they'd got us down in Ireland, I don't like to think of what would happen, because I know if they kick you, you know yourself, you could be almost killed by people.
Oh, certainly.
If you were on the ground and being kicked by hooligans that, you know. But I knew the only thing there was to face them, and in Camborne, I tried in the same way to stop them, but it wasn't much good, you know.
You were speaking, I suppose, and they were interrupting you, were they, at Camborne? I mean?
Yes, they wouldn't let me speak, as it were. They started just almost at once. It was a concerted thing.
Do you think they thought you were militants?
I think so. I think they thought we were militants. Mm. And it was no good trying to tell them, because you only had your voice in all those open-air meetings. I had a good carrying voice, but you only had your voice, and if they were very rowdy, your voice wouldn't even penetrate too far, you see. But anyhow, it's still a mystery to me why I think they thought we were militants and they were going to go for us.
What you say about Ireland, though, is very interesting, about home rule and so on. You were a home ruler, of course, weren't you?
I was. Yes, I didn't feel it was fair to see it, you know. And my father, as a matter of fact, always said that as a young man he joined Gladstone because he said he would go for home rule. Mm. You know?
Well, your father was obviously
quite a
good liberal,
young man, and he said that was what made him join Gladstone, that he said he'd be a home ruler. Because father thought they should have home rule.
Because
he thought it was the only way to.
You see, it's very interesting. The women's movement has just the same problems as the Chartists had in Ireland. The Irish are just interested in something else. They're not really interested in suffrage or chartism or whatever.
They weren't interested. They didn't. Where I got nice meetings in Ireland, as I say, were in sort of private drawing rooms and things like that, where they were people wanted to hear you. Mm. But not the mob in Ireland. The mob only wanted, the articulate mob only wanted home rule.
Yes, so you really noticed the difference.
I always remember, too, the Irish are lovely. I remember when I was going in a train and a porter took out my suitcase for the train and I was going to let's say it was Killarney, I can't remember, but this porter said to me, "You'll be going to one of the gentry." Wasn't this Irish? And I said, yes. And he said, "You'll be going to the..." And he named them. And I said, "Yes." You know, I was their guest. And he said, "Yes, I was sure you were going to the gentry." Now, you know, in Ireland then, there was the gentry and the ordinary people. And that porter said, yes.
And that was one of the problems for the suffragists, was it? That they were identified with the gentry, really, and not with the ordinary people.
You were identified with them.
That's interesting.
And I can see why there were sort of rowdy meetings in Ireland. Well, I used to get my speech in, you know, in the end, and got them to listen. But I can see that it was because their one feeling was that you were almost bound not to be a home ruler.
That's
what they call the gentry.
Let me ask you, if I may say, ask you one thing about your father. You gave a marvellous description of what your family childhood was like.
Yes.
But I forgot to ask you about discipline.
About
discipline.
Discipline, well, that's very interesting, because my father never in his life touched a child. I can't remember mother ever, but father's word was law, so to speak. You see, if father said you can't do that, you didn't do it. And he never enforced it with any discipline spoken of in his life. He had a horror, in fact, of beating, of any child being beaten or, touched. But if he said it, you just knew that that was authority.
And you wanted to obey him anyway, because you admired him, I suppose, as well.
Well, we all loved him, I think we all. Yes. And, you know, my mother, too, you know, my brother just died since you were here, you know, and at least before you. And when he was just at the end, his mind was absolutely like mine. And he was 97, was marvellous. And but he did see once when something was bothering him, and some noise in the nursing home, and he said to the nurse, "You get my mother to stop that." Now that was interesting. He never said his wife, who was a rather tiresome woman, by the way, but "You get my mother to stop that." Now I thought that was so significant of what our life was. Mother and father were the sort of, you know, the beings who protected us. You see, get mother to stop that. Do you see the protection in it?
Yes, that's interesting.
And mother used to protect other boys in the neighbourhood, because people then were awful for being fierce to their children, you know. And mother used to horrify mother. And mother would, you know, if the boys did something, you know, they'd break a window with a sling. Mother would always pay for it, you see, and always. It wouldn't matter if it was our boy, if it was one of the boys, you know, and they were all together, mother would pay. Because mother couldn't bear, and one of them who met my sister in Canada years and years after said, "Oh, what a lot of thrashings your mother saved me." Because she always went to the rescue of any child, you know. It didn't need to be her own children. Any child.
She loved children, did she?
Yes, and she was so good with them. She protected them, you know. And father, but father was good, because he was a disciplinarian, but only with his word. Only with his word. He never said anything except, no, you can't do that. And he would give you a reason, of course, usually, as to why you couldn't do it. But he was a good disciplinarian, but not enforcing it.
Not a martinet or anything,
not
no.
Enforcing it,
yes,
no.
Yes. No, that's interesting. I mean, you obviously had very good parents.
Awfully. I think we had wonderful. You know, looking back, I do think our parents were exceptional. And mother, George Fraser, you know, my nephew at Leicester, he wrote this poem on his grandmother and compared her, you know, to a rock that sort of falls down at the end, unchanging, never varied by anything. And that was true, but as I said in my book, he didn't know how kind she was. She was just like rock in principle, but her kindness was infinite, you see, so that George saw the rock-like quality, you know, that she never changed. You couldn't influence her, you couldn't take her away from what she really was, you know.
How did she cope when your father died?
Oh, she felt it very, very deeply, very deeply, very. I remember that so much, awful. It was awful, because he was so young, you see, it was awful. And we had a difficult time afterwards in some ways, you know. But the two of them were wonderful. And the thing was that we were not brought up with... We were brought up, as I say, with a discipline that was a word discipline. Or an argument discipline, almost, you might say.
Yes.
No, that's not wise, you know. Father would say, "No, that you can't do that, because it isn't wise, it isn't right, and you mustn't do it."
Yes, that's very interesting. I mean, that's the ideal way to bring up.
It is, I think. Yeah. And of course, as I say, I thought my brother saying, "Get mother to stop that noise," was so interesting, wasn't it?
That is it.
That 97, his mother.
Yes.
You had been away from her for so long that you couldn't come.
Well, I think your childhood sticks with you when you're older, doesn't it?
I mean, I think so.
You go back.
You know, you remember things, but it was the way Nurse was sort of, the maiden said that Nurse was quite startled. He said, "Get mother to stop that noise."
They were a partnership, your mother and father, weren't they? Very much.
Very much.
She went everywhere where
everywhere.
He went.
That's why she didn't do public work, because she was so interested in what he did. And when he went to things, he was president of this and that. You see, she always was with him in those things. And identity, and she didn't want an identity of her own, if one could say it, apart from his public identity. Mm. But she was very, very keen on his public identity. And she was critical of my George, my brother, who was town clerk of Aberdeen, very nice. Oh, George was delightful too. That's George Fraser's father.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was always critical of Ada because she thought Ada didn't identify herself enough
with George,
with
George's wife,
public activities. Mm. She always said Ada should be with George in those public activities, you know. She never bothered identifying herself with them. Mother did. Mother wouldn't have done public work on her own because she'd have said, well, I don't know enough about it, you know. But with Father,
that could have made her into an anti, couldn't it?
Could
have made her into an anti-suffragist, couldn't it, in a way? And yet she wasn't an
anti-suffragist. No, not a bit. Mm. She accepted suffrage just straight away. Mm. She had a very strong sense of the dignity of women, as it were. Mm. And you see, Father looked up to Mother. I can see that looking back. He realized that in some ways she was a better judge than him of people, for instance. And he had a great respect for his wife as well as love, if you know what I mean. He saw Mother's qualities very, very clearly, I think. Mm. Very clearly. He never had any difficulty in seeing how important she was, really.
So both of them were giving something to the relationship.
Both. It was a very ideal relationship, I think. Mm. I think it was the kind of relationship you want in marriage.
Oh, yes, it sounds ideal.
Because she, as I say, was absolutely at one with him in anything he did. You know, she supported him. Mm. That was it. That was right. If Jim did it,
yes,
it was right, you know. Which is a good wife, really. Well,
yes, provided Jim listens to her, which he did, you say,
yes.
I mean, on some things.
And besides, she would have been a critic if he was doing anything wrong, you see. She would have been a critic.
Yes, that's
her people were all very, very nice. Her mother and father. Her mother was a very strong personality. My father used to say, your grandmother's a remarkably strong personality, mother's mother. Mm. And her father wasn't, he was a gentler person, but a delightful person. Mm. But the mother, the grandmother, was really, in a way, in the character, almost the stronger of the two. Father used to say that. He said, your grandmother's a remarkable character.
So did you learn from your mother how to bring up children? I mean,
yes,
was that where
because, you see, there were so many younger, and even if you had maids, you see, you were always busy. Oh, no, I was always having the children. One friend said, I never saw you except a company bus full child when you were young. You know, I was always having them out, or taking them out. Or
do you think
that
was important in making you a good organiser? I mean,
yes.
The fact that you were head
the whole of that, and the whole mother was orderly, you see, and I was a very orderly little girl, and I was always, in a way, organising. I can see it looking back. I was always organising things in the house and everything. It was just innate.
And as the eldest child, you had many opportunities.
As the eldest child, and my sister, who was younger, you see, wasn't strong. And we always let her do next to nothing, you know. But if anything was wanted, it was me. Mm. You come and do this, you know, me. Mm. And I didn't mind, because I was strong and, you know, enjoyed it. Mm. And Anne would she even didn't have to bother much with the babies. I would get a baby. Mother would say, listen, go and watch the baby, you know, and see that he's all right. I'm going to do something or other, you see. And there was cradles in those days, and the little baby would be in a cradle, wouldn't, you know, those long
cradles. Yes, I know, on post.
Yes. And I would be watching. I had a lot to do with the children. A lot, you know, in a way, because as I say, and Mother wouldn't have trusted her babies to the maid. We had some awfully nice maids that you could have, but I've in my life I've known a story of a maid who damaged even child disease, you know. Mm. So mother would never have left her babies, do you see what I mean, except under her own sort of supervision or with me. She wouldn't have done it, just instinctively. Not because she was critical of the maids, but she just wouldn't have done it.
Mm. One thing that I wondered, why didn't you, when you left school, why didn't you go in for the law?
That was, you know, father didn't say law. Father said, would you like to be a doctor? And I said, no, Father, I wouldn't be a doctor or anything. And it was George, who was younger, you see, went in for law. And George, who said later, of course, you should have taken law. But, you know, I'm glad now that I never went to a university. That sounds rather wrong of me. Because I think I was remained more original by being left alone, if you understand. Mm-hmm. You see, I didn't really... I remember a school friend saying to me one day after I'd been at home for a while and been nothing but social, she said, you should be doing something. And, you know, it's sort of ridiculous of you not doing something. And I said, well, I just feel that I probably will. And you see, I really was meant to do what I did. Mm. And I was meant to sit still till the chance came, you know. But and if I'd gone to a university, you'd have got me into a pattern, and I would have gone into law, as you say. Well, I wouldn't have done what I've done.
No, I can see that.
I was meant to do broadly. Mind you, I've made mistakes. We all do. But I was meant to do broadly what I've done. I was meant to do it. It was my fate, almost, you might say.
So you never considered going to university?
I never considered. Mm. I studied. I did some studies. I didn't want to go for the whole term, you know, the whole time.
What sort of studies did you do, Mrs.
Well, Martin? I did some on money and economics, you know. That was
did
one
you?
Thing that interested me. Mm. And, of course, later, was in the national savings, you know, we were all keen on Keynes, you know, and so on. And of course I knew about Keynes through his mother, you know, in the early days. And I used to get books on economics and money and read those. I always found those very interesting.
It was just economics, was it? Nothing else? No other subjects?
Well, I liked history. I always liked history very much. I liked history. I read a lot of history.
You read novels, of course, didn't you? You were quite a novel
reader.
Yes,
I like good novels. Like Conrad. And of course, I always had Dickens. I remember as a child reading Dickens, when I was a little schoolgirl reading Dickens.
So did your father say you could just study what you liked? I mean, he didn't try and...
No, he didn't try to push me then. He said, well, you know, you should... You know, think what you want to do. He was awfully pleased when I started to speak. Because I think he had a feeling. You see, he sent me to get my voice sort of trained, which was very good advice. And he was delighted. He lived long enough to know that I had become a speaker and so on, you see. And he was delighted with that. I think he felt that was what I was meant to do, was to lecture, you see, and do that. And he was delighted with that.
And you lectured quite a lot on legal aspects of women's situations, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And later on, you did quite a lot of economic writing.
I spoke a good deal on... And that was how the National War Savings Committee telegraphed for me, because I had made speeches on the need of watching money and saving and, as it were, holding things in the war. And it was those speeches that Gilmore heard and
Bottomley
and Philip Kerr and so on that made them telegraph from London for me to come up and see them. It wasn't my own suffrage. It was those speeches that influenced them.
Yeah.
And I arranged a war exhibition showing... you know, with suggestions of what you could see and what you could do and so on. In that first war, you know, there was one stage at the last, in early 18, when we had only 6 weeks of wheat in Britain.
Is that so? Yes. Well, it was a very close squeeze, wasn't it?
It really was. And yeah. I seem to have an instinct for knowing that that was important to her.
After the war, were you thinking of becoming a journalist, really? I mean, becoming...
Well, I was asked once if I would... half suggested that I might... the Daily Mail might consider me for a sort of woman editor in the Mail. And I think I consulted about it, and I decided when I heard all that it meant that I wouldn't, I would be rather tired. It would be a kind of desk thing and not particularly interesting. And that was the only time I ever thought of tying up with the journalism. But of course I did an awful lot of freelance and it was then, you see, accepted so readily in a way. You couldn't get in now, could you? Well, it's only reviewing books.
That's
about the only thing, isn't it? Reviewing books in general, and there's not so much.
Mm.
That's about all. But in my day, well, as I say, I the Herald, the Scotsman, the Dundee Advertiser, the Aberdeen Journal, the Bulletin, the Manchester Guardian, the Yorkshire Post, another good paper, you know, the Observer, and what else? One of those London popular papers, Reynolds or something. I wrote things on Christabel, on suffrage things in that even. And you know, the Bulletin, I used to do very frequent things for the Bulletin, and I could write on anything for them. They didn't mind what it was. It was always usually women's things, naturally, but it wouldn't matter.
So did you write things first and then send them to a paper, or did they ask you for things?
Oh, no, I wrote them. I began by sending things, you know, and almost at once they were accepted, you know, because, for one thing, I was writing what they were sort of interested in, you see, and there was, I'm trying to think of her name, there was Miss Isaac of the Manchester Guardian. She was rather irritated with me once. She said, you know, in a way, you were rather a nuisance, she said. Here's the Manchester Guardian telling you to do the internationals for them. And she said, if you weren't there, I might get out. You see, the Manchester Guardian and the Yorkshire Post and the Herald took articles on those internationals, commissioned me, you know, said, send us two or three articles on the... as it goes on.
Right.
So that I used to get commissioned by the good papers to do the internationals. But I had broken in by sending them articles, which were nearly always accepted. I must have written quite well, you know.
Because the great problem for women after the First World War was that they didn't have any private incomes. People weren't being kept by their parents anymore, or really, you know, that side of things has gone. And yet they can't break into careers or professions.
No,
and I suppose you were trying to find one,
wasn't easy
you?
Then. It was a good thing I wrote, because lecturing, I didn't get much in lecturing in Britain because they didn't pay you well. I used to go over to America, you see, and do a short tour, and that paid you better.
Did it?
But England never paid you well. Well, they'd pay a few people, but in the whole it wasn't.
Where did you go in America, Mrs. Moyes? I mean,
when I did lectures, I went to all the main towns: Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago. You know, really, Kansas City. You know, just the main cities in those tours. In the war one, I sort of went almost everywhere, one might say. But in those tours, you really got the main cities.
Yes.
You were speaking in there.
Yes. Yes,
and they paid you well. You see, you got $75, say, for a lecture.
Did you have an agent who arranged
these? Yes.
You have to give him a commission.
Oh, you'll have to get an agent. You couldn't arrange it yourself. It wouldn't be wise either, I think.
Mm.
I had an agent, and they arranged it, and they take... I think they took about 10%. It wasn't... They weren't unfair to you at all. And when you left America, you they were quite right. They asked you to give them an account of what you had earned in America. And, you know, they allowed you a large sum for every day you were in America.
Mm.
Quite large
sum.
So you
could come back home quite a lot.
More generous than I needed, because I was getting hospitality. But what they allowed you was a sort of hotels, as it were, the whole time. So that I used to end up by paying a trifling sum for quite large sums of money, you know, that I earned. And I think I've got one sheet with, you know, lists of my fees. And they were very sort of generous to you if you earned money.
Yes.
And, you know, one friend of mine came out and did a few lectures, and Miss Mercer, and gave Hollery, showed Hollery the list to them at the end. And the man who was looking at it said, "I guess we owe you some money."
How often did you do these lecture tours then? Roughly?
I did about three after the war, you see. So that was why in those 25 periods, you know, that sort of period, I wasn't always in England anyhow.
Yes,
I was away for some months at a time.
So Mary Stocks can run the NUS.
Yes, I didn't bother with them much, you see, except, as I say, for a big meeting or for writing.
Yes.
And then when I came back, of course, the people always wanted me to write about the American women or something about them, you know.
Why did you write your autobiography, as a matter of interest? I mean, how did you come to write it, and when did you write it?
I wrote that really in the last years. But the only things I used in it from the past were the international stuff I had.
Mm.
I didn't use it for any of the family, naturally, or that bit where I say about second sight in Scotland. That naturally is just for myself. And I didn't use anything for the American bits. The only thing I used from the past was my articles on the internationals, which I looked up, you see, to see what they had. But
was it your family who persuaded you to write your life, or had you always wanted to do that? Or
what made me do it in the end? Let me think a minute. Why did I think of that?
It's an obvious thing to do in a way.
I think it was more the people in the people like the ESU people and so on, friends who said, "Well, why don't you write that down?"
Yeah.
It really was. I was influenced by people saying, when I spoke, you see, they would say, "Well, why don't you put that? You know, why don't you write it?"
So
why
eventually
don't you
decided
write it?
You
and
would.
It really was. It was really people saying to me, "Why don't you write that?" You know, when I told them stories like I've been telling you, they said, "Well, why don't you write that?" I had written a lot, it was easy for me to say, well, yes, I could write it. So that I really wrote that quite late, you know, just not long before it was published, really.
I see, yes. I just wondered how it originated.
But it was friends saying, "Why don't you write that?"
Mm.
Oh, and I think my nephew, too, George, said it to me, said, "Why don't you write
quite
that?"
Quite right.
Yes, why don't you write that? And he thought from one poem, you see, that I had written a lot of poetry. And I said, "No, I haven't. I haven't written a lot. And must have torn it up when I did." I really wrote that because friends kept saying, "Why don't you write that?"
I see.
"Why don't you write that?"
One thing which I meant to ask you last time was about Wales. I mean, you became well known in Wales
as
a suffrage worker.
Yes, very.
After you left the WSPU, that was, wasn't it? It was when you were in the.
It was when I was a constitutional,
yes.
I was never in Wales as a militant. Mm. No.
How did you get started in Wales?
Wales was very interesting to me in the war savings movement, too. I had known Cardiff, you see, as a constitutional, had a lovely time in Wales, speaking and building up their branches. But in the war savings movement, Glyn Jones was the commissioner for South Wales, or part of it, that part. And he couldn't get, this is interesting, he couldn't get chief, Evan Hughes, used to send me now and then to tough spots where they had rows or things to put them right. And he said to me, they can't get a committee in the Rhondda. And he said, Glyn Jones thinks you might. Glyn Jones evidently wasn't jealous, as it were, of me. He said, Glyn Jones thinks you might be of use. And I said, all right, I'll go down and see them. And I went up to the Rhondda, Pontypridd, you know, and had a meeting with all the miners. Hartshorne was there, the MP, you know, the whole gang of them. And I held forth. And at that time, there was a thing that controlled food things, you know, sort of, you know, you had a power over food things. And I knew that I had a weapon up my sleeve that I could use, you see. So I went on and said, you know, and told them all about it and said, you must have a committee here. And I said, you know, if you don't have a war savings committee, what are you going to do about the food one, which is linked, you know? I don't think you manage to get the food one if you don't let me get the war savings one. And, you know, they capitulated in Hartshorne. They had a little pull over the end of the hall. And Hartshorne, one of them, said, oh, yes, Miss Fraser, well, we'll set up a committee. And I said, right, now let's have your names, you know. And we set up the committee. Now, Glyn Jones, if he'd been clever, could have used that, really. Mm. Mind you, I didn't say definitely you can't, but I just said, now, look, this gets linked together. And if you want to be friendly with that, you better get in with us, too. Mm. And there was no reason why they shouldn't. The teachers and everybody were friendly, you know. Yeah. But so I got that right. And then there was a row up north with somebody who had offended a mayor up in Durham or Middlesbrough or somewhere. And I remember being sent up to put that straight.
So you were sort of a troubleshooter in a way.
They used to send me out to put things straight. But that Rhondda one was interesting because, you see, I knew the Welsh and I liked them and they knew me in suffrage. You know, those men all knew me. They were friendly. Yes, Hartshorne, they knew me. And I knew Cook, that famous miner.
Oh, yeah.
Man. I remember Cook coming over to me at a station to talk to me, you know, one day we were travelling. But I knew them and they were friendly to me in suffrage, you see.
How did you get started in Wales in the suffrage then?
They had a branch, a small branch, and Marjorie sent me down there and I stayed and built it up and Penarth and, you know, and right. And I went up to the university at Aberystwyth, Miss Fewing, stayed with them and founded there, you see. And those men, really, those mining men, didn't know me in a way, you see. They knew me as a suffragist before I did the war.
I see, so that helped, really.
Oh, it helped, because they were friendly to me on the whole. The Labour men were, on the whole, friendly, you know, to suffrage, you see.
Really?
And they were friendly.
Yes. Was there any special problem in Wales? I mean, why were you sent to Wales by the NUWSS? I mean,
I think they thought that a good speaker was very attractive in Wales. You see, the Welsh are very eloquent themselves. And as you know, they have finished up their thing with what they call the whirl, you know, the final flourish of the oratory. And they thought that I would be good in Wales because I was a really good speaker, rather moving. Well, you know, I could get them really done. And that's why they used me. Some of the women whom they sent to other places were not such good speakers, though I say it myself. They were good speakers, but they weren't so inspiring. And they chose me to go to Wales, I think, because Wales had been difficult when they had tried other people, they hadn't done much. Usually they hadn't succeeded very well. Because Welsh love an orator, you know. They just love it.
You noticed that, did you, when you went there?
Yes,
I mean, you noticed the difference.
If you can speak well, they like it. And they'll listen after a time just for the pleasure of hearing you speak well, you see. Mm. Where where the English wouldn't bother, you know, whether you spoke well or not. You
yes,
see, that the Welsh appreciated oratory.
Did it help that you were a Scotswoman, do you think?
It probably did, but I don't think they bothered so much about that.
Right.
Though it probably did help, because I can remember at one election of Bond's, where Ian McPherson came down, and he talked some Gaelic at a meeting, and which is like Welsh, Welsh, you know. And that was very popular, I remember. So that probably, you see, in a way, they knew that I, you know, that did influence them a little. But I liked them, you see. I liked them. And I think that does such a lot to
what,
do
what
with
do you
it.
Like about the Welsh? I mean,
well,
a lot of people don't like them.
They're very impudent. They're sort of difficult people in one way. But and they're deliciously curious. Before you were stopping, you know, I would get off a train in Wales and I'd be going somewhere and they'd say, and they would say, you'll be going to so-and-so. You know, they really are the most awful gossips. Well, you know, they really are lovely. Now, I liked them. I thought they were so amusing. And I had Welsh friends, women that I liked very much.
Who were your friends in Wales?
Well, Dr. Morris's two daughters were great friends of mine. Gert came. She was at London University and in the end, yes, that's right. And she came to London and stayed there, and I knew Gert very well. And Gert ended up in Norwich with a friend, and Elsie, her sister, stayed in Cardiff with aunts. Their mother had died when they were children.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a doctor up in the valleys, you know, the doctor with a lot of assistants, you know.
So you used to go and base yourself
so
with
I
them
used, yes, and that meant I knew people up in the valley. Now, that's awfully interesting, because up there in the valleys, you know, there was only the doctor and the schoolmaster and the ministers, and the rest were the miners.
So you need contacts to
there
make...
There was no middle class. I mean, it was almost like, I don't know... all the miners, and of course the miners had, in those days, they were all insured. Before Lloyd George's insurance, they paid into a fund, and the doctors looked after the miners and their wives and children. You know, they were looked after in the old days by doctors, and you got to know the whole set up by going into it, you know.
What about the Lewis family? You stayed with the Lewises, didn't you?
The Lewis family. That was a bit, of course, Mrs. Lewis was very fond of me, and the Colonel too, but I loved Mrs. Lewis. His uncle was the man who married the Mrs. Lewis. She became a widow, you remember,
yes,
and married Disraeli. Colonel Lewis was the nephew. Well, the old man, the widow's husband, left all the money except the bare estate, I gather, from Mrs. Lewis, to the widow. She was wealthy, you know. And so that when the Colonel got the estate, he didn't have so much money at all as the old Colonel had. But he had the village, you know, he had Tom Windlass, you know, and rent and things. I think she once told me that they had about 4,000 a year, which in those days wasn't bad, you know. And but her aunt, the aunt of him, his married aunt, Mrs. Lewis, she had got a lot of money. I think she had some herself, but the husband did leave her the bulk of his money.
And she was a suffragist, was she? Mrs. Lewis
was. Yes, she was one of the leading women in Cardiff. I used to stay with them a lot. She was very fond of me, as I say. And she was a keen suffragist. And the old colonel was quite friendly, you know. And Rupert, the older son, was. He wasn't much. I always wondered what happened to him. I wasn't trying to find out. Rupert, the younger son, was awfully nice. I liked Rupert. He was in the Welsh Guards. He went into the army, you know. But the older son inherited, actually. Now, he married one of the Williams, the wealthy court people, in Cardiff. So that, but I really, I would love to know. I do know a woman in Cardiff. I might ask her what's happened to whether Green Meadows still with William's family, you know, with the older son's family, because it came down, you know. Yes. And that was painted from Green Meadow, you see, off Castle Coe. Yes. That's the Buttes. Old castle that he spent a lot of money on in doing, you know, inside.
Oh, terrific, by the way, with William Burgess, didn't he, the architect?
Yes, he spent a lot on it.
Why was Mrs. Lewis a suffragist, do you think?
I think it was in her temperament. She was a very original woman, very, very interesting, and very learned, really. She was, studied history and... She knew languages well. She was quite artistic. She was a really quite a brilliant woman, and very, 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 very original in every way. And he was a keen suffragist, and very funny about anybody who wasn't.
Was she really? What did she say?
Quite amusing. Well, you know, she would be quite amusing about them. She was a keen suffragist. And that influenced a lot of the county people.
I see.
Because she was liked, and the meet used to go and meet at Green Meadow, you know, the hunt and so on. So that her influence was very, very useful. Mm. And there were some other very nice, because the Thomas, you know, Rhonda.
Rhonda,
he was South Wales. They were rather critical of Rhonda in a way. They thought he was pretty sharp. But the Williams were in it. They were wealthy. And the shipping people, you know, there were a lot of those. They were nearly all influenced by Mrs. Lewis to be friendly to suffrage,
Were they all Anglicans, actually, Church of England people?
No. There were a lot of Congregationalists and some Methodists. There were quite mixed.
Well, I was wondering, you see, whether your Presbyterianism helped at all in Wales.
Because there were Presbyterians, there were everything in that Welsh group.
And nonconformity wouldn't be alien to you, would it, at all?
Not at all. And it wasn't to them in Wales.
No.
The Anglicans, of course, had been the kind of chief ones, but I never found that they were narrow about it.
Mm.
Not even the Anglicans.
Mm.
Not on the whole, not the ones. Of course, I made the more progressive ones, I suppose.
Why do you think Mrs. Lewis liked you so much?
I don't know. She always said, I'd like her to be my daughter, you know. She just liked me, because we were both rather, I should think, Madame, actually, original in a way, you know.
Yes, you had a lot of shared interests.
We got on awfully well in that way. But we could talk about everything, and she was interested in almost everything. She was interested in Egypt and South America, you know, she was interested in things. Mm. And she was interested in the fact that I was interested in things. She was.
So you met her first because you went to Wales for the suffrage, really. That's how you first met her.
That's how I met her.
And then if you had her behind you, then you obviously do much better.
She was very useful. Mm. And then the head of the high school for girls, Miss Collin, was a great help too. She was a Cambridge, the East Coast she was born in, and... She built in Cardiff a very good girls' sort of high school, you see, and then it was taken over and made the high school. She had worked with, you know, Miss Buss and the old. So she was a strong suffragist, which was very good in the education field. And I used to stay with her too, you see, at the house, at the parade where the school was. And that school was taken over. And I remember she told me later that it was taken over at a salary, a sort of modest sort of salary, but she was to get £1 a head for every pupil as well. And the school grew so much that The Education Authority got frightened and said they'd give her a bigger salary and stop it because our school was getting to hundreds, you know, which was rather nice. But it was a very good, she was very able, and she was a very able head, you know, of the school.
You see, you've got, what you're
and
really...
And then there was the woman at Penarth who was awfully nice. She was from Newport in Monmouth. She was an awfully nice headmistress too. You see, I got to know all the headmistresses. And Miss Davies from Carmarthen was a delightful headmistress, as Welsh as you like, but delightful. You know, I got to know all the headmistresses, you see, and they were nearly all, they were all suffragists. They were all swooped into the suffrage movement, so that Wales had a very representative group of women.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that the NUWSS captures the most intelligent women in South Wales.
It did. The movement got the most intelligent women, got the women that were leaders. Mabel Howell, they had a big store, hadn't they, the house. Mabel was a keen suffragist, and her friend, Miss Richards, I got a little etching or something that was done, I think it's that one, done by her sister. You know, she was an artist.
They're talented women.
But those people in, and Mrs. McKenzie, who was on the staff at Cardiff University, she was, you see, all the leading women around there were suffragists.
What about WSPU in South Wales? Was that at all?
It wasn't anything.
Active?
It wasn't. It didn't. It didn't exist. Mm. It really didn't exist. Mm. It didn't exist.
And this type of woman wouldn't be sympathetic to it.
It didn't exist. It wouldn't have appealed to them much because they were nearly all women of some distinction. You might say heads, you see, and so on. And with their staffs, they had staffs, and the staffs were all members, you know, most of them became members of the suffrage, so that you built up very, very good groups in Wales, but mostly on the intelligent women, as it were, the leading women. It weren't all Welsh, by the way. You see, Miss Collin was English, you see, but that didn't matter. I never found the Welsh being narrow about anything like that.
You became quite a figure locally, really.
Yes, in Wales I was very well known, and that's why in the war savings, you see, I said to Bottomley, Alfred Bottomley, when he said about giving an area, I said I could do South Wales, and he said, oh no, a man must do that, you see, and I said, all right, but you see, I could have done South Wales quite well, but it didn't matter, I got the home counties. He said, oh no, a man must do that, but you see, I went to the rescue of the man.
So you joined the South Wales procession in the pilgrimage. You started off in the west
and
of England.
Then they asked me to move to them and speak on their platform with an Iron Williams, you know, who was an MP, and Mrs. Streeter and I think we were the three, I think.
So you had tremendous experience, really. You had experience of Ireland, Wales, Scotland.
And
I mean,
England.
You know.
I don't know that anyone had more experience of suffrage than I did, because nobody worked in Wales as much as I did. None of them. None of them.
That's fair.
No, none of them worked in Wales. I almost could say that I had Wales as the, you know, was the chief woman from London for Wales. And then you didn't need to go was Manchester and those places, because the Manchester women were strong themselves, and they didn't need our help, really. The smaller towns in England, you see, I did things with, Leicester and so on, but those big towns got the Manchester one dated back to the 1860s, you see.
Yes, well, that started off, really. Yes, of course.
So that, you see, they didn't need us. They didn't need our speakers like that. Scotland needed them, and Wales needed them more.
Did you find that the suffragists were mostly in the towns in Wales, or was it really in the country as well?
Oh, it was in the country. You see, when I say country, I mean country towns. The farms.
I mean, you went from town to town, really.
Carnarvon, Carmarthen, Pontypool. You know, Yes, and right up to Aberystwyth, where they had good groups among the university people and so on.
Did they? Yes. But one of the great...
Sorry. And the young girls, they interested the students, you see, too. Mm. Yes, it was all very good. And there was somebody in one of the Welsh towns, I think what it was, Mrs. Morgan, was awfully good. She did a lot of sort of propaganda in her own area, you know.
Because one of the problems about Wales is difficulty of getting from one place to another, that is a difficulty, isn't it?
It was difficult, because, you know, yes, it was. And
did you go by train?
Yes, you mostly went by train, and the trains were very mixed, you know. The mining trains were just like cattle things, almost, you know, like, you know, rough and things. But you went by train mostly. Yeah, wait a minute. It was
always
train, because there were no cars. You went by train.
That's interesting. But you were the election expert for the NUWSS as well, weren't you? I mean, you used to go along to by-elections and fight the campaign.
I did by-elections. I did by-elections at places like Bristol and Durham, and you see, all over the country. Mm. I did 21, so you can see that was a lot. Yeah.
Well, tell me, can we just discuss the Hexham one, the one where you had all those articles?
That was a very early by-election. You see, that was when I was with the Pankhurst. Mm. And I was saying, Mrs. Pankhurst, I was in Scotland, you know, supposed to be running Scotland, as they say. And she said, go to Hexham, and Nell Kenny will join.